We all know the feeling of Christmas time coming and not knowing what to give the loved ones. Nobody wants another uninspired voucher under the tree. This year, we've got you covered with the new Australian Geographic Christmas Gift Guide, including telescopes, games and educational toys. Get your Christmas shopping right this year and shop at QBD Books or online at australiangeographic.com/catalogue. Hi, I'm Chrissy Goldrick and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Andrew Gregory. Andrew is well known to readers of Australian Geographic as an intrepid remote area photographer. He's also an awarded adventurer. But today we're talking to Andrew about powerful owls, and in particular the ones that live in his own backyard. Andrew has become a passionate conservationist since a family of powerful owls moved in next door. So I'm really excited to be talking owls with Andrew Gregory. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Chrissy.
Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
In our little studio, a long way from the kind of environments that we usually find you. As I say, those great big sweeping landscapes when you've been shooting all around Australia for Australian Geographic. You're one of our remote area photographers. You have absolutely no problem packing all of your gear into a four-wheel drive and taking off for weeks on end to get those amazing photographs in those very remote areas. But I can't really move on to that smaller environment that I just spoke about without actually returning to that reference to the rather close encounter with a saltwater crocodile that you had when you were on your expedition to the Ord River back in 2006. So tell us a little bit about what happened that day.
That day was quite an epic day because I could see it coming. We had been warned by people that used to fish up in the upper reaches of the Ord River that we would encounter saltwater crocodiles. And this is a this is the bottom end of Lake Argyle, which is about 100 kilometres deep at that stage, and a long, long, long way from the coast. And we'd already been paddling down. We started at the Negro River and then we went down that comes into the Ord River. And we knew that we'd reached the bottom end of Lake Argyle when we stopped having the water flow, when the water went still, and then we had to put the hard work of paddling
right into the kayak because you're in a pair of kayaks at the time.
That's right. So up until that point, we'd been kayaking through rapids and cascades and really, really clear water with lots of freshwater crocodiles and big freshwater crocodiles. Up there, they're so big they have like stripes on them. They're very, very, you know, well over 2 metres.
So these are the freshies, but you're not worried about the freshwaters even when
they're
that big?
No, we'd seen so many freshies. We'd bumped into them and, you know, they get close, but we weren't particularly concerned about it. We'd seen so many by that stage. But we reached this section of the river that was different colour because it had a lot of sediment. The river suddenly got very wide, and there were sandy banks with reeds on them. And we camped that night, and that next morning we headed off and it was dead still and very hot. And we felt like we were heading off into this sort of unknown area where we might encounter the freshwater. And we see wallabies on the side of the river on the banks. So it was prime place for a crocodile and for saltwater, I mean. And I think it was probably getting towards lunchtime that I was out in the middle of the river, and I thought I'd seen something before that, but then something in the water, something moving.
Like a log.
Well, no, actually ripples. And,
right.
And, you know, movement
some of those
in
clues.
The water.
Mm.
And I think probably the biggest clue that something was different was we started to see less freshwater crocodiles. because we were seeing them all the time, and then it just became this big, still, wide river. And I remember Kieran had gone over to the right bank, and he was paddling under the shade of the trees. And so it's quite a distance between us. And I just think that I was, because I was filming at the time too, I had a camera, I had a still and a video camera with me on the deck all the time. And I think I must have seen, looking back now, I think it was probably some wallabies or something on the side of the bank which attracted my attention. And then I just saw this crocodile.
In the water.
Big crocodile coming straight for me.
Right.
And he was as big as my kayak. And my kayak, well, he may not be as big as my kayak, but pretty close to it. Like, my kayak was 5 metres long. I would say he's probably more like a 3 metre long crocodile.
Yeah.
And he looked me straight in the eye. And then I actually got some footage. I actually picked up the camera and took about 6 seconds.
Like a good AG photographer should.
That's right. I couldn't think of what else to do. But and then he went under the water, and he went under the kayak, and I could just see this ring of bubbles sort of coming up around the kayak. And so because I sort of knew a bit about how crocodiles worked, I knew that he'd just gone to the bottom under the kayak, and he was just sitting there. And so I just sat there perfectly still for, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 minutes, I think, quite a while. And by that stage, Kieran had seen that something was a bit weird. I wasn't making any noise. I was trying to be quiet. But he'd gone to the shore. And eventually I thought, well, you know, I have to get out of here somehow.
So was that the right thing to do, is to not move? You didn't really think to start paddling madly away or anything. You thought, no, I need to stay still.
Well, that's right. I think I wasn't really sure what to do, but I think that I assumed that this is a crocodile that hadn't seen anything like a big red kayak ever and was just curious, you know. And if I just tried to not make any sort of movement or, you know, not to disturb him, hopefully he was just going to
go away,
leave me alone. And
but he didn't go away.
Yeah, eventually I remember paddling to the shore with just the tips of my paddle, like just as slowly as I could. And we got to the shore, and we sat down, and we had some lunch, and we waited probably a good hour, and we still didn't see him come up.
Right.
And then we decided, well, let's go. And we just headed.
So you got back in those kayaks.
We were quite close to the shore, like I say, on this shadowed sort of bank. And we just kept going. We must have paddled another 10 kilometres or so. And then we got to this big, big bend in the river. And on that bend was this huge slide, a huge crocodile slide.
Right, and that would have belonged to that crocodile.
Yeah, or another even bigger one.
Right.
It was an enormous slide. And we stayed there for a little while, and then we just thought that we'd just keep going. And that night, I remember that was quite a scary night, because we got to this sort of confluence of all the other rivers, and it's just a big wetland. And we were we spent ages trying to find somewhere to actually
camp. Yeah, there's nowhere to haul yourselves out, I guess.
Yeah, so we just found this narrow strip of land, which was really just big enough for a tent, and because we were just like sleeping in the inners of tents, and that's where we spent the night, knowing that there were crocodiles around.
Oh, well, yeah. Look, that's a pretty scary story, and I would say that, you know, I don't know whether you remember what you felt like when you were sitting there like a sitting duck in that kayak. Were you scared?
Yeah, I was scared.
Yeah, I bet you were scared.
Yeah. And like I say, because I'd had an injury too, I wasn't that quick, you know. Kieran was paddling much quicker than I was, and I had a lot more gear too. So, it was. Yeah. And we still had so far to go. We hadn't even reached the proper bottom end of Lake Argyle.
So you're coming down. So the Ord River comes down, and then it was dammed back in the 19... 20s, I think, or was it the 50s? Anyway, we'll find out about that. And then it created Lake Argyle, which is a really huge body of water, and that's obviously where you were heading for.
Yeah, once we got into Lake Argyle, we followed the course of the original Ward River, and that was sort of our intention, to try to get a perspective of what it had been like before the dam. And it would have been stunning.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment.
We have a great subscription offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our digital edition for 12 months for just $24.99. That's 6 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your inbox for less than $4.20 an issue. Only $24.99 for a full year. So don't wait. To subscribe, go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
That's one of your many adventures whilst undergoing Australian Geographic business, and that did get you the award, Spirit of Adventure. Mm. And we're very happy that both you and Kieran sort of came out of that in more or less in one piece. And you've had many adventures since then. But I think why you're here today to talk about a much smaller scale adventure that you're currently having in your own backyard. And this is a sort of a year that we're talking a lot at Australian Geographic about the amazing things that we can find without having to go too far, because in this year of 2020, many of us can't go very far, and we haven't been able to wander too far from our own backyards for months now. So there is magic to be found there, and that's what you have found in the back garden of your new house. When I say new house, you moved in about 4 years ago. So tell us a little bit about where your house is, and start to tell us the story of the unfolding story of the whole wildlife haven that exists in your own backyard.
My place is in the northern beaches of Sydney, and it's a the house is one of the original properties in the area, and it was built where it was because it was on a small waterfall, and there would have been pools next to the house when they first built it. So it's a bit weird. It sort of like doesn't face the same way as all the other houses, because it was actually built before the roads were even there. So at the back of it, and this is quite similar to a lot of places in Sydney, there's a rainforest gully with literal rainforest remnants in it. And that section behind us wouldn't have had a house because we couldn't have accessed it, and it's too steep. So they're the sort of areas that get left and turned into reserves, or just become places that are inaccessible. And if they are owned, sometimes they aren't even built on. And it's the water that makes our place pretty much a special spot. It's got a lot of spotted gums, tall eucalyptus spotted gums, but the water cascades down and has a series of pools and little waterfalls, and then it actually flows right underneath our house. So when it rains, we get really big deluges, but in between time, it's like stream-fed, so there's always a trickle of water, and there's always these little pools. And that's the key thing that attracts the wildlife, and that's also allowed the sort of habitat to build up, and we get, you know, we got species like cheese trees and cabbage palms, and as well as tall gums on the edge of this sort of like little rainforest patch along the creek, and then it's more a woodland to the side of it. Mm. And that actually has contributed to quite a range of species relying on that little pocket as a place to live and a place to breed and a place to also seek shelter.
Yeah, so tell us, you've obviously got the kind of species that most of us might spot in our backyards, possums.
Yeah, we have there's ringtail possums, brush-tail possums, bandicoots, but we've got other things. You know, we have bats. We don't have a bat colony, but we have bats coming into the palms frequently.
Small, like microbats?
We have microbats, yeah. We actually have something really unusual, which is a quite ancient stand of giant bamboo, which was planted maybe even 100 years ago or 70 years ago. It's huge. And that's actually sort of acting like a giant fig tree. And there are holes in that, and it's actually full of native bees and microbats all breeding in there.
Okay, so there doesn't always have to be native plants to provide
it's,
habitat
it's
for
exotic,
native
but
species.
It is a big habitat magnet.
Interesting.
Yeah, because of bamboo, like the bamboo is probably as thick as my leg. These really long, up to 30 metre high. It's the type of bamboo they use for scaffolding in certain countries. But when it splits, it forms great little pockets for animals to nest in, like microbats particularly, and also the native bees.
Now, you were out with your lovely wife Marcel one night when you first moved in, and you heard some bird sounds that you perhaps didn't really recognise, that you didn't know. Some sounds started coming from the garden. Tell us that story.
Well, one thing I've learned after travelling, and Marcel and I both say this, after travelling all over the place and spending so many nights out bush, is that if you thought you heard something, you actually did hear something. So we learned to trust our ears, and Marcel's got really good hearing. And she picked up the sound, which was like a high-pitched trilling sort of noise. She picked it up straight away as being something she hadn't heard before. And when she first heard it, I actually couldn't hear it. So I had to wait probably another week before she kept saying, I can hear the sound, can hear. And she'd go outside and tell me and eventually I did hear it. It's a really high trilling, high-pitched trilling noise, and it's quite sheer, very, very high sort of range. And it was quite continuous, and it was obviously a baby calling its mother, but we couldn't work out what species it was. Like, we didn't know whether it was a bird or whether it was an animal or a glider or some type of thing like that. This was in winter, so we'd been having... we sort of got a backyard fire pit. We've been having fires out the back, and one night we were sitting around the fire, and suddenly there was this huge baby powerful owl just perched right above us. It just flew in. We heard the sound getting closer and closer, and then it just landed only a few metres away from us. Wow. And was fascinated with the fire and with us, I think. And we were just blown away. Because the baby powerful owls are just absolutely gorgeous. They're all white on their chest, and they've got this weird sort of habit of bobbing back and forth and moving their head around. Because their eyes don't sort of move in their sockets, they move their head to see things. They can turn their head so they move their head to see different directions, and they're constantly moving around, and they can turn their head right upside down. They look upside down at you and... back and forth, and they trill and they get so excited, you know, they're just amazing things. And they can't fly very well because they haven't got a tail feather, so they just sort of crash into things, you know. So it sort of crashed into the trees right above where we were, and we spent most of the night watching it. And then the next morning there it was in a tree just near our backyard with Mum and Dad roosting there.
All three of them together?
Yeah,
then.
All three of them together. Yeah.
And did you go looking for them, or is that what happened? Did you get up the next morning and think, I wonder if it's close by?
Went out the back door and I could spot? See it. I could see it from our back door. It's right there. So I come pretty much close to right where our back door is. There's a little sort of pool and a waterfall, and above that there's some... cheese trees with a nice canopy, and it was just roosting in that area there.
And how did you know it was a powerful owl? Is that just because you know your owls, or was it just the size, sheer size? Tell us about powerful owls.
A powerful owl, to start with, it's a very big bird. So it's the largest of our owl species, and I've actually got a picture of a life-size picture of a powerful owl, and I would say, you know, it's about 65 centimetres, a male owl. So it's really from your head to your waist.
Yeah.
It's like you're talking about
that
size.
That's a big owl.
That's a big bird. And its wingspan is about 1.4 metres, almost 1.5 metres. And it's got this distinctive sort of feathers where if you get a powerful owl feather, it's sort of banded. It's like a dark brown and a light brown, like a stripe on the feather. And on their chest, they've got these it's mostly white, but then they've got brown V-shaped chevrons, almost looks like a bird in flight on their chest. And they've got, around their face, they've got a distinctive mask, like black feathers around their face on a lighter coloured face. And then big yellow feet with feathers on them, really, really big feet and big black talons, you know, really.
And the eyes as well, yellow as well in the eyes?
The eyes are stunning. They're really, really bright, bright, searingly bright yellow and big black iris. And I've photographed them so much with my camera, I can actually see the iris moving, contracting or dilating. It's changing size. And the males have a squarer head than the females. Females have a much rounder head. And when they fly at night, they are completely silent. They've got a ruffle edge to their feathers. So that makes them silent and fight. That's most owls are like that. If you look at sort of like a magpie feather and you hear a magpie fly, it's got quite a sheer edge, but the owls have got this ruffled edge to their feathers.
So that they can fly in stealth.
Yeah, they're completely silent. It's quite like I watch them sometimes at night. At dusk, they will go up to a high tree ready to fly off, and then without warning, they'll just spread their wings and they're gone, and they just glide, and it's completely silent.
You don't hear a thing. Yeah. And so you spotted the three of them. What were they doing? I mean, were they out in the middle of
that was in the middle of the day. So because I've described all the sort of the nature of our place, it's a perfect roost site for a powerful owl. So that's where they hang out during the day. And according to the different sort of conditions, like whether it's windy or hot or cold, they'll go to different trees. Like there's trees they prefer if it's windy, if it's hot. There's trees that have more shelter over them. They roost around, and I can sort of work out where they'll be just according to the weather.
And are they territorial? So is that their territory?
That's their territory.
So they will always be there.
That's
all
right.
Things
so
being equal.
So they have, we have a nest tree, which is a big old grey gum with a hollow in it, and that's where they breed, and that's sort of in the bushland area. But to have a successful breeding couple, they've got to have an adequate sized nest tree, but the nest tree has to be in an area that will function as like a nursery for the baby owls, because the baby owls take so long to mature, and their parents have to teach them how to hunt, and really, you know, they'd have to learn how to fly. So it's good, you know, 5 to 6 months before they can look after themselves. Right. So they need to sort of, from when they fledge, be in that area where they can sort of hang out. So what would happen from then on, once we saw that owl, is mum and dad would go off hunting in the evening and they would leave the owl there. So you need that sort of nursery, that sort of area where the babies can
And the
stay.
Babies explore on their own. I guess that's what
yeah,
that one was doing when
right.
it came down
that's
to say
right.
hello to
and
you.
And they got to the stage where, because they'd seen us from the moment they fledged, this first owl became really quite sort of attached to us. And Marcel could go to the back door and call, and she could imitate the trill perfectly, which I'm not very good at, but she's really good at doing that. And it would actually come to her.
Is that something we can hear? Shall we have a little bit of a listen to the trill of the little owl, so that we can at least start to hear what these owls sound like, you know, because as you say,
that's right, yeah.
You often hear the birds before you see them, and it's good to know. So I'm just going to play a little soundtrack here.
I've spoken to people that also live in other areas near owls, and I've actually played that sound, and they will go, "Oh, I've heard that," and they don't know what it is. They just hear this weird sort of sound, and it's a really loud sound too. It carries for a long, long way. So those sort of sounds there, that's on that sound, you can hear the mother. she's calling to the baby, and sometimes you can hear the mother, and she'll make these weird sort of sounds and calls, basically telling the baby to come here or to go there, or, you know, that she wants it to be quiet or she wants to feed it. And the baby will get really, really excited. And we've sometimes lie in bed at night listening to that right outside our window.
That's wonderful, isn't it? Well, let's hear the sound of the powerful owl itself, because I guess we all hear owl sounds, but we don't necessarily know which species we're listening to. This is the, and we'll probably play a couple of owl sounds so you can start to hear the difference. This is the male powerful owl. Now that is a sound that we might think we're hearing in our, you know, local sort of bushland or backyards. But let's also listen to the sound of the boobook, which might be something that perhaps more common, and so that we start to hear the difference between these owls. Now, I'm much more likely to hear something like the boobook, I think, especially in our backyards around Sydney. So for somebody to be able to sort of hear that and listen to the powerful owl call and recognise it as that, that's something special and something that, you know, sort of for you started a journey, really, for you and Marcel in terms of your relationship with powerful owls. So tell us, you know, from the time that you first observed the owls and saw their behaviour, what happened after that in terms of powerful owls and the Gregories?
Well, because they became such a big part of our lives, we're living with these owls 24 hours a day, and we get to see every aspect of their life and the dramas and the traumas and all that sort of thing that goes with it. We became involved with the Powerful Owl Project, which is a bird life project to basically monitor the owls that we have, to find out where they are. And really, it's all about sort of collecting data and protecting nest trees. So we'd sort of go out to different areas and find owls or listen to owls or discover owls in different locations. I grew to know what sort of by their calls, actually, I'd sort of get to notice different behaviour. I'd sort of know what was happening by listening to them.
We'll be right back with our conversation after this.
We have a great subscription offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our digital edition for 12 months for just $24.99. That's 6 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your inbox for less than $4.20 an issue. Only $24.99 for a full year. So don't wait. To subscribe, go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
And you've been observing your own powerful owls in your own backyard and obviously all these other powerful owls that you've gone out and you've been seeking in bushland in different areas. So this is like a citizen's, you're really like a citizen science now. This is the Powerful Owls Project is a citizen science project by, run under the auspices of BirdLife Australia. So how does it work? What actually do the volunteer participants do?
Well, they have... Beth Mott is the person that I've been working with mostly. She's the coordinator of the project. They will run volunteer workshops where she will tell people about the owls and what to look for and go out in the field and identify all the aspects that you need to know. It's about like learning how to be like an owl tracker. You know, it's learning what to look for. And, like, I can go out in a place now and if there is an owl around, I'll find it fairly quickly because I've learnt to notice all the signs that go with that. And they have an app which you download. It's a bird data app and you can record your sightings as a survey. And that's all – the locations are kept secret, but it all goes into a database. And that can be used principally to protect the nest trees because it's very important that they are protected, because they're such a significant aspect of the owl breeding, the nest trees. But also it sort of helps record unusual behaviour that, like this year I had something quite unusual happen. I was watching this owl in another reserve, this pair in another reserve, and they had one owl that was about ready to fledge. So I'd been going in there every day and watching to see when this owl fledged. And we had a really hot day, and this was in September, and the owl came out of the baby owlet, came out of the hollow, and I thought, well, usually once they come out, they're fledged and that's it. And I went back the next day and it had got cold again and it had gone back into the into the hollow, and it stayed in there for another 3 days before it then eventually came out. So that's, you know, that's unusual behaviour.
Yeah, so do you find now that because you're spending so much time with this species that you yourself are witnessing behaviour that may not have been recorded before?
Oh, yeah, I'm finding very unusual. Like, for example, I have seen the owls hunting on the ground. Everyone just assumes that they... it's always assumed that they just swoop in and take their prey, either on rooftops or, you know, from branches or, you know, arboreal sort of species in the actual trees. But I have actually, and observing them quite frequently now, actually hunting on the ground, sort of like a kookaburra would do, where they're actually sitting on the ground and then waiting till something goes past and then pouncing on it.
Wow.
And... so, yeah, like actually being on the ground a lot more than I would have thought.
Does that make them vulnerable, being on the ground?
Definitely,
like that?
Yeah, definitely makes them more vulnerable, and also makes them wary about being on the ground, which is, you know, like, yeah, I mean, there's lots of threats, obviously, when they're on the ground. So, yeah, it is quite vulnerable. But that's the sort of thing they would do if they're hunting something like young brush turkeys.
Right, yeah.
Which will be on the ground, you know.
And that's interesting because that just brings us really to the threats, which, I mean, it is a threatened species. Am I right about that, the powerful owl?
Yeah, it's listed as vulnerable, but they've had such a bad year this year. Far fewer owls fledging than normal.
The bushfire year or...?
Yeah, after this last bushfire year. So the status might be revised.
Might change.
Yeah, they're becoming far more vulnerable.
And tell us, obviously, I mean, quite clearly, you've got powerful owls in a patch of suburban bushland. So that immediately tells us a little bit of a story anyway, because, as you say, it's on such a steep slope, can't be built on. So habitat loss is obviously probably the greatest threat.
Yep.
Two powerful owls, and we know that that's something that we know a little bit about. But tell us some of the other things that impact this really sort of keystone kind of species.
Well, apart from the habitat loss, they're very vulnerable to collision. They're either flying into windows or getting hit by cars. I think probably 80% of their mortality every year is from car strike, and that's because they will fly low over a road and they'll hunt on roads. And, I mean, the reason we're getting owls in the urban areas is because they're not actually doing that well in the bush. So they are moving into urban areas to try to catch prey, and that's because for various reasons there's not as much prey in the bush as there used to be. And so yeah, I have observed, and they will sort of roost or perch on the edge of roadways and then swoop over and get hit by cars.
And is there anything really that, I mean, I guess the cars, they, as we you were saying before, they're silent, they're dark, you know, they're stealth hunters. There's probably not an awful lot that the drivers can really do. What about are there in particular areas where, for instance, around where you are, that signs go up warning drivers that there might maybe owls flying?
It's something that I'd like my local council to do, but they're sort of not really aware of that, trying to educate people more about that. Because I've released an owl from Taronga Zoo that Libby Hall there looks after the rescued owls, and almost all the ones that she has in have been hit by collision by a car. And what happens with an owl when it gets hit by a car? It might sort of look okay, and then fly off eventually, but it might have a little fracture in its sort of head, and then when it flies, the pressure of flying can basically kill it. So they do need a long time to recover. So when they're sort of brought in from a collision, they'll be in captivity for a month until they heal before they can be released.
And is that something that happens quite regularly? Do people pick them up and rescue them and call wires or take them to...
Yeah, well, I think last year they had 8 owls brought in, and 4 of them were actually ended up being released. 4 actually died.
Yeah.
So it does happen frequently, but we lost our first, the owl that fledged the first year, and it lived to be about 6 months. It was hit by a car on our street.
Oh, yes.
And we didn't find out until we actually started speaking to the neighbours, and somebody had actually buried it in their backyard. If we hadn't asked, we wouldn't have found out. But once that actually happened, it just went missing, and we actually watched the mum and dad grieving for it, actually, for about a week.
Right. Oh,
yeah.
That must have been very tragic for you guys as well, because you must have been watching it there for a while.
Yeah, it was just getting to that stage where it was becoming independent, and that was a young male, and then suddenly it was gone.
Yeah. And what happened? What happened after that? Did they have another chick? And
yeah, they. That was probably around. That was in the summer, and then they did start breeding again. So, it's usually around. I mean, they're real lovebirds. Around April, May, they have this whole courtship thing where they have these weird sort of calls, and they start calling to each other. The male. They're reared together, and they're actually really sort of very affectionate, you know. They're really affectionate. And the male actually prepares the hollow. So he actually makes sure that the hollow is ready for him to defend.
Mm-hmm.
And then the female goes into the hollow, and she's in there for close to a couple of months or over 2 months.
Right.
And he defends the hollow for the whole time. So that's why I say it's all got to be really perfect for them to breed, and because he sits right next to that tree that whole time, and he hunts for her, and he'll come back with the prey, and he'll call her, and she'll come out, and he'll feed her. And
For a big species like that, you need a big hollow in a tree to be able to make a nest. And I guess that brings us to yet another one of the pressures on big bird species like that, and that is the loss of these big tree hollows because we're losing old trees. So tell us a little bit about how that plays out, particularly in the suburbs of the big cities, in places that most of us live.
Well, the hollow that we have is in a living tree. But in our reserve, it is the only tree that has a hollow that big. And in a lot of other reserves, there may only be 2 or 3 or even 1 hollow that's big enough for the owl. It has to be quite a major hollow, but also deep, because they're in there for a long time. And one of the other successful ones I know, whereby this one I was telling you where the owl just went back in, that's a dead tree. That's a tree that would have been dead for maybe 20 years. And so that the pressures that we have, particularly in urban areas, is to get rid of trees that are dead.
Hmm.
Quite often an old tree, a dead tree, will form a hollow or have a hollow and become quite a successful breeding site. But we tend to get rid of them quite quickly. We tend to remove trees rather than maybe leaving a stump for a hollow to form. And the whole habit of clearing land has made hollows even rarer. And when we do hazard reduction burns, sometimes what will happen is the fire will get into either a dead tree that has a hollow, and the nature of once you have a fire in there, then it will sort of destroy that hollow because it will burn it out. And sometimes, you know, after fires, trees get pushed over after they've been burnt, but they can actually become good, really quite
if they're left,
successful breeding.
If they're left to stand, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not just for owls. Like, I mean, sometimes trees have multiple hollows, and there's been actually even, occasions where you'll have the owls breeding in one hollow, and then you might have kookaburras breeding in another hollow in the same tree. Because quite often these trees which have hollows have quite successful, and it's really, really once the owls have left the hollow, it's straight away. It's filled with some other
something
species.
Else takes up residence. Yep,
they're just waiting. It's like there's like a queue.
It's so important, isn't it? And I think when we see the trees, we don't often see the habitat that's like secretly sort of part of that whole ecosystem that we're looking up at. And it's really important that we keep the trees, but we're not keeping the trees. We're actually losing trees at a very alarming rate these days, and especially in the suburbs.
Yeah. It has been a bad year for us. We've had a couple of occasions of illegal land clearing, and mostly just for views, people just cutting trees or cutting limbs and branches for views, or poisoning trees. And people also don't realise the significance of the understory. It's not just the big trees, but there are other trees like cheese trees, which really form good sort of a really good canopy, and people just get rid of those. So yeah, we need to value the reason for it, and because I've had so much exposure with these owls, I've learnt to really appreciate how special they are, and I'm just trying to educate people to realise, you know, that these things are here, and just to think about the way you sort of might manage your own backyard.
Because we've been all home during the last few months with COVID, and we've all been madly sort of gardening and planting veggies and getting chooks and getting extra dogs. And some of these things have, you know, maybe made us feel better about spending time at home, but they haven't necessarily been that beneficial for our native creatures that we share our backyards with. Isn't that right?
That is right. Well, it has been, you know, the negative aspect of that has been a bad year for wildlife, and all those elements you talked about, like for example, like dogs. I know lots of people have got dogs or two dogs now, and they're letting their dogs roam into reserves. They're letting them unleashed in reserves. I was just describing how owls actually go on the ground and will hunt on the ground, and they all animals go down to the ground to drink, and if there's dogs regularly patrolling an area, even if they don't kill any wildlife, they're going to disturb that wildlife and actually make them not use that area, which is... the problem with that is that a lot of areas that are set aside as wildlife protection areas all have paths through them, and people are all walking their dogs through these paths, whether they are allowed to or not. I see it all the time because I'm always in these reserves and I'm seeing dogs everywhere, you know.
And it's not about not having them, and it's not about not letting them out for walks, but it's really about making sure that they walk where they're supposed to, because if they're banned from walking, you know, there's probably a very good reason why that is.
Yeah, it's being responsible, really. We all know that you don't let cats out, but, you know, there's been studies which suggest that dogs kill more urban wildlife than cats. And, you know, having seen what I've seen, you know, I know that they kill possums, they kill bandicoots, they injure birds. But people just don't see them as being an issue or a problem. It's difficult because everybody loves their dogs. So it's just sort of thinking about where they are going and what they're doing.
And tell us also... backyard chooks. Now, you wouldn't think that backyard chooks would pose a problem, but they do in a roundabout way.
Yeah, that's really, you know, unfortunately, one of the negative aspects of having chooks is you may end up with rats, and so people can put out rat poison, and there are certain types of rat poisons here which are freely available in Australia, that accumulate a lot of rat poison in them, and the rats, if they are eaten by the owls, can build up toxicity. And I know that there are a lot of owls sort of dying from excess rat poison, you know. So that's another thing. You really should be controlling the way you're baiting your rats and the type of poison you're using.
And can you choose a poison that's going to be less harmful? Is that a choice you can make? Can you go and find out that information and ask?
Yes. BirdLife's got some really good information on that. But there's a first generation and a second generation rat poison. The second generation ones are the worst, and they're actually, in a lot of other countries like the States, they're actually banned.
Right.
But here you can buy them in the supermarket or the hardware. And that's just education. It's just people being aware of that. You know, I've seen it myself. But I have trail cameras. I know that there are people down the road with the chook pen, and I have actually seen rats come and drink out of my bird bath as they're dying because they want to have a drink. So, yeah, I'm seeing it, and that sort of worries me because the owls will take those rats.
Yeah. And tell us, you know, that's sort of the bad news, but the good news is what can people actually do to help? What can they do in their own backyards, even if they haven't heard whether they've got any powerful owls? But they certainly have a whole range of other birds coming and a lot of wildlife there. What can people do really to sort of get on board, perhaps listening to what you say about some things people may not be aware of that they're doing and their behaviours are doing to sort of harm native wildlife in the backyard? But what things can people do, simple things, to encourage native backyard wildlife?
Well, it's the way you plant and manage your backyard can actually increase the amount of wildlife that is visiting it. So the first thing I would say, if you want to sort of look after back wildlife in your backyard, is to have some sort of water feature. It can be just a simple bird bath that you wash out regularly, or even a little pond or something. But just a bowl or something will be the first thing that will attract all the wildlife there. The second thing you're going to need is you want shelter. So what you need to do is you want to build up that whole complex level of vegetation that starts with the insects and then leads to the smaller things like the lizards and the small birds, and then the smaller mammals, like you might get the gliders or you might have your possums. So it's building up that little complex area in your backyard. So instead of having the whole backyard area cleared and then maybe a few plants or maybe somewhere that's mulched and all that sort of stuff, one way you can look at it is, like, some golf courses have actually quite a lot of habitat on them. And that's because in between the fairways they've got the roughs. So it's sort of like the same thing in your backyard. It's like planting that area of rough, that rough section where you've got lots of like native grasses or small bushes or prickly bushes or areas that the insects and the small animals can hide out. And then it's just building up that layer. So underneath that or above that you've got a second story and then a third story, and you've got these different sort of canopies and different levels on your
and they don't property. Need to be native plantings either.
No, it doesn't. This one of the things in my local council is that there's a tree exemption list where there's a whole range of species that you can actually just chop down without a permit. You don't need to contact the council, you don't need to do anything, and that can include, like, at our place I've got a massive old bunya tree which I think would be about 70 years old. It is one of the most favourite roost spots for the owls. They love that tree. But I could cut it down without even asking the council at all. And same with a lot of species, even though they're native. So the bunya is a native species, but it's not native to the area. So there's a lot of other species, like certain types of palms. There's things like flame trees, which might be a significant sort of tree, but you can easily get rid of it because you're meant to have certain trees that are only native to that particular area that you're. And this is one of the problems with these little green fingers, these little habitat pockets, is because you may have somewhere that's been left or a block of land that nobody's built on for 100 years or something, or has never been built on, that suddenly gets subdivided. And then it may be have species which are native, but they're not native to the area, and they're, because they're on that exemption list, can just be cleared.
Out they come, yeah. Yep. So it's it's interesting just to note that they don't need to be native plantings in your garden, and it's a good excuse actually not to do gardening, isn't it? It's actually just garden a little bit if you have to, but you can actually let that garden run a little bit riot, and you'll be doing your local wildlife a big favour. And right. You'll also benefit from that, because there's nothing more beautiful than seeing those native birds coming down into the garden to visit, yeah. and maybe to be fed, or certainly sort of checking in. It's a great sight, and it's one of the things that we're so lucky to be able to enjoy in Australia, that in many big cities around the world they don't get to see very much at all, apart from the odd pigeon. So I think we should really try and appreciate our wildlife a lot more. But I think from talking to you today, Andrew, there's plenty of things that you can do to get more involved. And certainly the Powerful Owl Project is a project that you can have a look. If you can go to the BirdLife Australia website and look up the Powerful Owl Project, that's a great citizen science project that uses an app on your phone, from what I understand, to record sightings. So these are easy ways to start getting involved in local and native wildlife. And I think once you start, a bit like you, Andrew, you can't really stop, can you? It can sort of become a way of life.
Yeah. And it is really rewarding, you know, like to get so close to these birds. But also, by building habitat for them, we've got all these other. It's amazing how many species we have. Like we have sugar gliders and you know, microbats and all these sort of other wrens and different birds.
And even though we live in these cities and these suburbs, and that goes for right in the centre of big cities like Melbourne and Sydney. We're creating wildlife corridors between big areas of built infrastructure when we have gardens like that. It's not really always about having huge areas of public reserve land, but just by maintaining these sort of wild areas in our gardens, we can create these corridors and animals can move around.
Yeah, well, in a lot of areas, the backyards are the corridors. We haven't actually, the planning didn't allow for a lot of corridors, so in between reserves the animals are moving through backyards, so your backyard can just be part of that corridor if you're sort of managing it for the wildlife, and they will use it as a stepping stone, and you'll be seeing more and more.
It's wonderful, and you don't have to do the gardening either, so it's a win-win for everybody. So thank you very much, Andrew Gregg. It's just been wonderful to share your experience of the Powerful Owls. I think we'll have some photographs of the Powerful Owl on our website, on the Australian Geographic website, been taken by Andrew, and also some footage of the behaviour. So go to our website and have a look and search under Powerful Owl.
One of the most amazing things is seeing the owls in the bird bath. I have this huge bird bath that I put in, and the actual owls will have a bath in that. So that's something.
And that was behaviour that probably hadn't been witnessed before.
No. That was something that I saw that there was a need for, because the creek was drying up in that really bad summer, when the smoke was really bad and
2019, yep, yes.
That's right. So I searched for this huge bird bath, and they took to it straight away. And it's quite amazing.
And it's a simple installation, a bird bath, and then it sort of transformed your experience and probably provided a really important water source for those powerful owls.
That's right. And they get in there and actually wash their face. You can see them washing their eyes out on those really smoky days.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you today. Thank you, Andrew Gregory.
Thanks for the chat, Chrissy.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram, @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.